We turn to Nehemiah. Now, Nehemiah comes back about 445. That, you see, is about, the other was 58. That's 12 or 14 years after Ezra. Ezra had come back. Now, he returns, and he brings a group with him. Now, what is his work? His work is going to be rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem and rebuilding the city. They've got the temple built. They haven't rebuilt the walls there now. So, really, the restoration movement was not completed, you see, until from 536 until 442, about 90 years later, almost 100 years later, so the whole restoration was completed. The restoration movement in the church, of which we're a part, began back in about 1800, just before that, along that time. Now, then nearly 200 years later, well, it looks like we're ready for another restoration, a new one within the restoration. But it took a good while to get things going just right, not as long as it did with them. Well, we turn to Nehemiah then. He was cupbearer to Artaxerxes. We'll notice that in just a moment. He came about 445. He was governor for 12 years. Then he had to return to the king, and I think the king let him come back. I think he really returned after that. I'm not sure of that right now. All right. We're looking out into the book of Nehemiah. And so now we're about down to about 445, about 12, 15 years after Ezra had come. The words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakalah. Now it came to pass in the month Chislev, in the 20th year, as I was in Shushan the palace, and that's the capital, one of the capitals of Persia, the three capitals of Persia, this was one of them. Now, there is a question about this date. Ezra came back, there's a little conflict that I'm not able to solve, and I never gave much time to it. I just know that there's some error there on the part of some scribe or somebody that doesn't, in other words, affect my belief in the Word of God. Now, I was in Shushan the palace, that Hanani, one of my brothers, as either his brother in the flesh or a kinsman, a close kinsman, and he came, Hanani, one of my brethren, came, he and certain men out of Judah, and I asked them concerning the Jews that had escaped, that were left in the captivity, of the captivity, and concerning Jerusalem. Now notice his interest. Here he's a cupbearer to the king, but he's very concerned about his brothers of the captivity returned. What happened to them? How they getting along over there? Right now his brother Hanani tells him. And they said unto me, that is Hanani and those that came with him, and they said unto me, the remnant that are left of the captivity, remember I pointed out the emphasis of this remnant last Sunday before that there was a remnant that returned. I made the observation that that's all God ever promised that would return, would be a remnant. Now, the millennialists today are arguing that the promises of God to bring the Jews back was not fulfilled. Well, there's five or six passages that I could turn to immediately and show that they were fulfilled. The promises were fulfilled. And the remnants, all that was ever promised, he'd bring back. So the remnant that are left of the captivity there in the province are in great affliction and reproach. The wall of Jerusalem also is broken down, and the gates thereof are burned with fire. All right, now notice that the reputation is in reproach. I think that was because of these Jews marrying foreign women there, having to deal with that. So that was a reproach upon the people, and the walls were still torn up. It had been cast down since 587 or 6 when Nebuchadnezzar destroyed the city. Now over 100 years later, they haven't rebuilt it. So they haven't carried on the work that they should have done in going back home. They delayed it. All right, so that burned with fire. And it came to pass when I heard these words, that I sat down and wept and mourned certain days, and I fasted and prayed before the God of heaven and said, now here's his prayer, a very devout man, now a man that had a great reputation with Artaxerxes and the others there, and I beseech thee, O Jehovah, now notice his prayer, I beseech thee, O Jehovah, the God of heaven, the great and terrible God, and keep his covenant and loving kindness with them that love him, and keep his commandments. Now, so God keeps his part of the covenant, if they will keep their part. Let thine ear now be attentive, and thine eyes open, that thou mayest hearken unto the prayer of thy servant, which I pray before thee at this time, day and night, for the children of Israel, thy servants, while I confess the sins of the children of Israel, which we have sinned against thee. Now notice that. Here's a confession of sin. Here's earnest. He fasts. He prays. He's praying day and night. And of course, it takes a little time of sleep, I'm sure, but what he means is I'm constantly praying about this situation. Well, that shows his faith in God. And shows that he realizes that sins and that God and the power of prayer in coming to him. This is the thing that's impressed me in studying the Bible from the beginning of my study, is the power of prayer, the place of prayer in the faithful servants of God. How much emphasis they put on it. How important it is. And we don't lose sight of that. Prayer is an act of faith. It's an expression of one's dependence upon a higher being. Now, that's my definition of prayer. It's an act of faith. It's an acknowledgement of one's dependence upon a higher being. But a third thing is, it conveys the idea of faith. Faith in him. He is a prayer-hearing God. He will hear our prayers and will answer them. He may not always answer the way we want them to be answered. He may have something else in mind in store. So, don't say because God didn't answer my prayer, he didn't hear it. That may not be true. But God may have heard the prayer, but something is involved that hindered the hearing of it. I dealt with that in times past, so I won't go into it now. Yea, I and my father's house have sinned. We have dealt very corruptly against thee, and have not kept the commandments, nor the statutes, nor the ordinances, which thou commandest thy servant Moses. So he identifies himself with the people, as sharing in the guilt of the people. Maybe himself had not sinned as some of them had. He recognized the fact that maybe he didn't do what he should have done in standing against those sins. So therefore we'd be guilty of that. So I don't have to be a party to the sin itself. To be guilty. Moses said in the commandments of God, thou shalt not follow a multitude to do evil. And then Paul said, have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, but rather even reprove them for the things that are done in secret by them in secret, ashamed to mention of them. Now, so if I know something's going on, something is happening, and I don't speak up against it, I don't reprove it, I share in the consequence of that sin. Well, we had that Sunday or two ago, last Sunday it was, when I turned back to the third chapter of Ezekiel there. And God said, Son of man, I have made thee a watchman of the house of Israel. Hear the word of my mouth and give them warning from me. Now he said, if you warn the wicked man, he turns from his wickedness. He said, he shall not die, and you've delivered your own soul. But if he sins and you don't warn him, he will die in his sins. But his blood will I require at thy hand. So you see, it isn't only whether I participate directly in a sin. If I condone that and do not speak out against it, then I will have to share a part of the consequence of it. And that's what the Bible's teaching. And that's what every preacher and every teacher and every elder, a responsibility has in his work, and every father and every mother toward their children and toward others, is I must not only refrain from the practice, I must speak out against it. I must condemn the thing that's wrong. Well, do we really do that very often? Not too often, do we? A little light sometimes in our acceptance of what God says, of what he really says, and my responsibility in that which he says. We listen to the sermon, we listen to the lesson, we go out straightway, we forget what we heard. You see, I read our Bible, not intently, but we want to see what is said. And then we forget that. And we all do, every one of us. So that means then that I must give constant attention to what God said, lest I be guilty by default. Not that I've committed the sin, but that I didn't say anything against it. I just let it go ahead. You see what I'm saying? Isn't that correct? I think so. All right. Now remember, I beseech thee, still praying to Jehovah, remember, I beseech thee, the word that thou commandest thy servant Moses, saying, if you trespass, I will scatter you abroad among the peoples. But if you return unto me and keep my commandments and do them, though you are outcast in the uttermost part of the heavens, yet will I gather them from thence and will bring them into this place that I have chosen to cause my name to dwell there. Now I want to look at those two passages. Look at Leviticus 26 and 20 and 33. Leviticus 26 and 33 and Deuteronomy 30. All right. I'll find this out. Leviticus 26, 33. I'll read both of them. And I will bring you the land. Now here he's telling them, if, look up here at verse 27, if you will not for all this hearken unto me, but walk contrary unto me. Now look at verse 32. And I will bring the land into desolation, and your enemies that dwell therein shall be astonished at it. And you will I scatter among these nations, and I will draw out the sword after you, and your land shall be a desolation, and your cities shall be a waste. All right, so that's what God said, and you have it also in Deuteronomy 28. Now look at Deuteronomy 30. Then after they've been scattered abroad and carried away about, now here's what he said, if you return, here in chapter 30, and it shall come to pass, when all these things will come upon thee, the blessing and the curse which I have set before thee, and thou shalt call them to mind among all the nations, whither Jehovah thy God hath driven thee. Now God said in Deuteronomy, I'll drive you among them. And I said, when you remember among those nations where you are driven, and shalt return unto Jehovah thy God, and shalt obey his voice, for in all that I command thee this day, thou and thy children, with all thy heart and with all thy soul, that then Jehovah thy God will turn thy captivity and have compassion upon thee, and will return and gather thee from all the peoples whither Jehovah thy God has scattered thee. Right, so now there's your, what God will do then. You move over here to verses 9 and 10. And Jehovah thy God will make thee a plenteous with all the work of thy hand and the fruit of thy body, the fruit of thy cattle, the fruit of thy ground for good. For Jehovah will again rejoice over thee for good as he rejoiced over thy fathers. If thou shalt obey the voice of Jehovah thy God, to keep his commandments and his statutes, which are written in this book of the law, if thou turn unto Jehovah, of thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul. What are your if conditions? Now then, so God, and that's what's in the mind of Nehemiah as he prayed. Now look at what he says again in the light of that. When he says up here, verse 8, remember, I beseech thee, the word that thou commandest thy servant Moses, saying, if you trespass, I'll scatter you abroad among the peoples. That was in Leviticus 26, 33. Now, second, but if you return unto me and keep my commandments and do them, though you're outcast from the uttermost part of the heavens, yet will I gather them from thence and will bring them unto this place that I have chosen to cause thy name to dwell there. So that's the promise in Deuteronomy 30. So now then, Nehemiah, in praying, is laying before Jehovah the penalty that they have been suffered and endured in being carried away. Now they have the promise of God, they've been brought back. So he's remembering that now. Now note the next statement he makes here, when he said in that verse 10, now these are thy servants and thy people, whom thou hast redeemed by thy great power and by thy strong hand. So now he said this remnant over here in verse 3, the remnant, now these are thy servants, they are the remnant of those that have been redeemed. So God has fulfilled what he said he would do. He has brought back the remnant, he has redeemed them. But now then, they're lapsing back into disobedience. And this is the thing that deeply concerns Nehemiah, this good and godly man. Right, now look at verse 11. O Lord, I beseech thee, let now thine ear be attentive to the prayer of thy servant, and to the prayer of thy servants, all of them, who delight to fear thy name, and prosper, I pray thee, thy servant, this day, and grant him mercy in the sight of this man. All right? As I'm sure you think about the king there. So he's going in and make a petition to the king. Now you grant me mercy as I come before him. So here before he goes into Artaxerxes, and before he makes a request of him, he prays this great and wonderful prayer unto Jehovah. As I've said before, I think a good series of lessons would be to go through the Bible, and I have done that in years gone by a number of times. Just study the prayers themselves. I don't know, might have done it here, I don't recall. Don't think so. Just go through and just study the prayers. Not necessarily, just see how they prayed, what they prayed for, and the intensity of that, the fervor of that prayer. All of that should impress us as we split that study. All right, so we made that prayer. Now he said, now I was cupbearer to the king. Now that says a great deal. A cupbearer had a very responsible position. For there were always those people, he acted toward the king like the Secret Service men do for the president. Now they would try to get to him, try to poison his food, or poison his wine, or get to him in some way. Now he stood between that individual and the king. He was a cupbearer. He tasted that wine. He was responsible for it. He laid his life on the line in tasting of it to see that it was not poisoned before he presented it unto the king. So as a cupbearer, he was very close to the king and a very responsible individual in his service. Now this is the man we're talking about. Right? And it came to pass in the month Nisan, in the 20th year of Artaxerxes, the king, when wine was before him, that I took up the wine and gave it unto the king. And he, the wine, and he goes in and pours it out, and hey, apparently tastes it. I think he had to do that. And he presents it to the king. Now, I had not been before time sad in his presence. And that's another thing. Those old Oriental kings, you didn't dare come before one of them with sadness. They wanted everything before them to have the appearance that everything was fine. You just happened to be in his presence in his service. So to come into his presence sad, with a sad countenance, was to invite rebuke or maybe even death from him. And the king said unto me, why is thy countenance sad, seeing thou art not sick? This is nothing else but sorrow of heart. The king recognized, you're not sick, but you're sad, so it must be sadness of heart. Then I was very sore afraid. Why? Because he'd never come before the king sad. That was an absolute no-no. All right. And I said unto the king, let the king live forever. Why should not my countenance be sad? When the city, the place of my father's sepulchres, lieth waste, and the gates thereof are consumed with fire. Then the king said unto me, for what dost thou make request? What is your request then? So he tells him that the condition there, and this is why he's sad. Now notice this next, so for what dost thou make request? Now notice, so I prayed to the God of heaven. What did I say about prayer? I don't have to get off the building somewhere. He was standing, it was a silent prayer. He prayed in his heart unto God that what he made request for might be granted. So he prayed for it. Right? So I prayed to the God of heaven. And I said unto the king, if it please the king, and if thy servant hath found favor in thy sight, if thou wouldst send me unto Judah, unto the city of my father's sepulchres, that I may build it, that I build the city back up as in ruins. So he said. Right, now the king has another question. And the king said unto me, the queen also sitting by him, I don't know what the significance of that would be, for how long shall thy journey be, and when wilt thou return? So it pleased the king to send me, and I set him a time. Moreover, I said unto the king, if it please the king, let letters be given me to the governors beyond the river, that they may let me pass through till I come unto Judah. All right, so those beyond the river would be looking at it from either Judah's point of view, or beyond the Euphrates River, the Tigris Euphrates there, beyond the Tigris River, I guess it would be. Which one was that? I forget now. Which one was east and west? Well, I'm slipping for a moment. Anyway, it'd be beyond the, whichever river, the Tigris or Euphrates. And a letter unto Asaph, keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the castle, which appertaineth to the house, and for the wall of the city, and for the house that I shall enter into. And the king granted me according to the good hand of my God unto me. So notice he recognizes that the granting of all of this by the king is the will of Jehovah. His God is gracious to him, blessing him. So with that in mind, he's going to set out now on his trip under the blessings of God. I think I have just time. No, I really don't have time. I'll read it and then we'll leave it there and stop. Then I came to the governors beyond the river and gave them the king's letters. Now the king has sent with me captains of the army with horsemen. So he had a guard when he went back, which Ezra didn't ask for and wouldn't accept. And when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah, the servant the Amorite, heard of it, it grieved them exceedingly, for that there was come a man to seek the welfare of the children of Israel. Now, the Sanballat the Horonite, Beth Horon was in the southern part of Ephraim, or ancient Israel. Apparently, he was from there. And this other fellow here, he was the Ammonite. He'd be of the tribe of Ammon. Now, Sanballat apparently, though I couldn't prove that, apparently was an individual that was a result of the bringing in of foreigners who intermarried with the Jews of Israel that were left when Sargon took Samaria and carried Israel into captivity. Then he brought back a group of foreigners, and they intermarried and became what's known as the Samaritan group. So apparently this is what he was, just a half Jew. So I came to Jerusalem and was there 3 days. And I rose at night, and in the night, and I'm going to stop there. What time is it? No, I got 5. No, I can do what I want to do. Excuse me. Oh, yeah, I can do what I want to do. Was there 3 days, and I rose in the night and came, and some few men with me, neither told I any man what my God put into my heart to do for Jerusalem. Now, where are you going to see what the conditions are firsthand before he begins to make amends for? Neither was there any beast with me save the beast that I rode upon. And I went out by night by the valley gate, even toward the jackal gate, and to the dung gate, and viewed the walls of Jerusalem, which were broken down, and the gates thereof were consumed with fire. Then I went on to the fountain gate and to the king's pool, but there was no place for the beast that was under me to pass. Then went I up in the night by the brook and viewed the wall, and I turned back and entered into the valley gate, and so returned. And the rulers knew not whither I had went, or what I did, neither had I as yet told it to the Jews, nor to the priests, nor to the nobles, nor to the rulers, nor to the rest that did the work. All right, so I'm going to stop there, because I want to say more about this other next time. Now, what he has done, he's come. Now, he reached the city, and after 3 days, he takes out the night, as we read, and he makes this journey around the city, viewing the walls. He wants to get a first-hand view of them. And you see the condition of them. Now then, he has a plan for restoring these walls, in spite of the fact they're going to have a lot of opposition. You're going to see as we go along, there's opposition from without, from Sanballat and Tobiah, and another fellow named Geshem, or they call it a different name here, but it was this fellow, Gashmu, these are going to oppose him. Then he's going to find opposition from within. Well, the nobles, the rulers, are getting rich over that. They're not contributing anything. So that's going to be a problem. Then also you have the problem with the workers themselves. They're working hard, but they're being oppressed by those that are over them. So they got back, they're lapsing right back in the old situation condition. I want to tell you, it doesn't look like the Jews have ever changed much. If you know much about them, it looks like they're still the same old descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Especially Jacob. He was a rascal, and he had faith and yet a rascal at the same time. At any rate, Nehemiah now is back. He geared the walls. He's ready to begin work and to face the opposition. But he's going to finish those walls. But I want you to know further, also, it's a matter of faith in God and work. His faith in God led him to his deep, humble prayers. That was his faith. But then his desire to see it accomplished led him to work hard. He, class, is an excellent illustration of faith plus works. Prayer versus works. Now, while I'm praying, I should be doing all I can do at the same time. That's what God expects of us. When I get through, God still will have given me the answer to my prayer because I was willing to pray and work at the same time. I'm going to leave that there and start there next time with that verse 17. That's excuse.